I wonder whether we can start this conversation by asking our audience to close their eyes for a second and just picture the idea of artificial intelligence. What is the first image that comes to your mind when you do this exercise? But how many of you have the image of a spider web or the image of a slime mold? This is the kind of pictures that we have tried to bring up in our work and in our book.
Welcome to the WGSN Create Tomorrow podcast, which we've taken on the road to Hackney to visit Marco Paletto and Claudia Pesquero, architects, academics, and co-founders of Ecologic Studio. Partners in both work and life, Marco and Claudia met at Turin Polytechnic while studying engineering before attending London's Architectural Association. They founded their studio in 2005 and as proponents of biodesign are doing very interesting work on how we might create a better future, learning from non-human species and microorganisms. Algae, fungi, slime mold. Yes, you heard that right. They've just published Deep Green, Biodesign in the Age of Artificial Intelligence as well. So there's lots going on. And there's some very strange bubbling sounds going on that you can probably hear in the background. Thanks for having us to your studio, Marco and Claudia. What is this incredible looking, describe it for the audience, three giant test tubes in very arresting colours of a kind of acid green, a lovely kind of orange and a deep, deep green. What's going on here?
Well, we are re-metabolizing carbon dioxide as we speak. So essentially, we are partnering with this microorganism called algae or microalgae, which are cyanobacteria, essentially photosynthetic microorganisms. And the reason why they appear in this array of colors is that they exist in a huge variety of strands and species. So they are not just one organism, but they constitute what we call the urban microbiome. It's almost like a hidden layer of nature which exists in every city, every canal, waterways, ponds, and essentially represents an untapped value for the future of our urban environment.
And you developed this. It's called Biobombola.
Yeah, the product design project in itself is called Biobombola. It's a home garden for microalgae and cyanobacteria. It can cultivate multiple species of microalgae and in that way create new alliances and new home ecologies because microalgae can feed. For them is food, nutrients, what for us is pollutant. So we can cultivate spirulina, chlorella, porphyridium, the red one, and other. Spirulina in particular is also a nutrient. We have it at home and harvest it regularly, and it's a little green blob when you harvest it and integrate it in food. It's very nutritious. This is because there is also another very interesting fact about microalgae, differently from mechanical filter, where you remove elements from there, but essentially the elements are still there. You need to dispose them of them somehow. Being these element nutrients and food for microalgae, they re-metabolize them. They grow cells, they grow other products that we can use as a food, as biomaterial, and in particular with spirulina as a food and nutrients.
And I have to ask, what does it taste like? Because I know you've got two kids, and I think when I spoke to you during lockdown, you were eating it, and there's a lot of protein in it. And something like this can produce, I think there's some incredible statistics in your book about how much you can produce from a bit of algae that a person needs each day.
The taste of fresh spirulina is actually quite delicate, but it's got a little bit of a taste, I would say, of nutty and grass, because of the high amount of protein is similar to nuts in a way, and can be eaten fresh in a salad or integrated into the dough or pasta or bread or frittata.
And other aspects, you talk about other types of algae as well. I understand some of them are good for things like beauty and there's other ways they can be used. Algae is becoming this kind of superpower material, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just because they exist in such a variety of species. And let's not forget, they are one of the oldest organisms on Earth. Like, they are partially responsible for creating the atmosphere that we breathe, like starting photosynthesis when there was no other organisms around able to do that. So in a sense, they have evolved in billions of years, literally, and in that way, they have developed what we call the biological intelligence, which in a sense means they can survive in pretty much any ecosystem or any condition, including highly polluted or challenging urban conditions, as well as glaciers or deserts. And so that means that they have developed different strategies to cope with these conditions, and they are able to metabolize different enzymes and to be able to cope with these conditions. And these turn to be, of course, useful to us. Now, of course, with biotechnology and so on, we are able to extract, we are able to utilize these substances in ways that it was not possible before. And that's why they are becoming more and more an important element of multiple industries, not only, you know, food, but nutraceutical and even medicines and biomaterials and so on. So there is a huge amount of applications that can come out of this. The question is, of course, which is the question that interests us, is how do we embed their growth and their cultivation in a new spatial framework so that they don't just become, let's say, another technological innovation in an industry that keeps operating in a sort of disconnected way from nature and from the urban fabric, but that we also create a new framework for them to be grown, cultivated, and eventually consumed, so that new type of circular processes, circular economies can emerge out of this. And that's where, in a sense, we think the biggest interest lies. They are very tiny organisms. So effectively, one of these glass vessels that we have here, it's about 10 liters of algae growing them, and they are small enough to be housed pretty much anywhere. And for the algae, from the point of view of the algae, there is enough room, enough space in one of these vessels to create an entire habitat, an entire world for them to grow. So that means that we can essentially begin to embed them in the urban fabric in many different configurations, from, you know, building facades to interiors to public realm and so on.
Cyber gardening is a great word, and it really kind of puts together, like your title of your book, Deep Green in a sort of a world of AI. I think what's really interesting in your book is when you talk about the fact that we've got this very sophisticated technical world now where we can measure our carbon footprint, and yet the actual measuring of the carbon footprint is increasing the carbon footprint, and that kind of trajectory that we're on. And obviously you're sort of tackling that with what you're doing, and the work you're doing is to kind of embed the bio and make it interconnected. I think for listeners, a really amazing thing that you did was your Biosynthetica architecture project. I'd love you to talk a little bit about that and explain it and describe how that looked, which was again using algae, and it was making a building completely self-sufficient, right, with its energy. So by sort of this amazing curtain that you draped over a facade. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The word cyber gardening and connecting biology's intelligence is really to the point, because in cyber gardening we refer to cybernetic, and cybernetic is not only about technology, it's also a paradigm of communication. It's one of the branch of engineering that allows to integrate sensor and system that allow recognizing target. Was developed during the war, but then second order cybernetic was really about machine that were able to interact with human. And in that sense, the book, by talking about biodesign in the age of artificial intelligence, really try to expand the notion of intelligence beyond artificial one, and recognize that there are multiple intelligent systems that we can interact with, some of which are energy consuming and some of which are actually energy producer. And we can recognize the intelligence of fungi, slime mold, and microalgae through their pattern. By interacting to the pattern of color, pattern of growth, we are able to read, they convey information to us, with which we can establish a conversation, and through which we can establish, in a way, circular economies.
I think today we talk about intelligence all the time, no? But in a very dumb way. We kind of think of, for example, we often refer to humans as very intelligent because we have a big brain and intelligence in the brain. And then you talk about smart cities and cities where, you know, softwares control everything that becomes perfectly timed and efficient. Or we talk about AI as a phone that can do everything for you and so on and so forth. Or ChatGPT that writes for you. And I think the project like Photosynthetica, for example, it's really started also from this idea of questioning where we can find intelligence today, and you know, what is intelligence in fact, and in a sense the possibility to embed organisms like microalgae on a building facade and make it responsive, make it alive, just seemed like a very interesting way for us to bring this paradigm of smart architecture, responsive architecture, in a different milieu, like where all of a sudden the intelligence is not contained in a box or in an algorithm, but it's really about this exchange between different systems. In this case, when you have these thin layers of algae suspended in front of a building facade, all of a sudden they are not just a filter between the indoor and the outdoor, but also they become a biosensor in kind of changing color, in responding to changing microclimatic pattern, concentration of pollutants and nutrients. So they communicate to you as well as you pass by. And if you pass in front of that facade every day, even without you noticing, you will begin to read patterns. You will begin to understand, oh, you know, it's been red for a while, and then look, now it's going into green. You know, what's going on? And I think that's where we can begin to shift the conversation through cyber gardening, through this type of integration of living systems in architecture in our city. There is a level of intelligence that emerges in the interaction, that emerges in systems of different nature, humans, non-humans, biological, digital, feeding information to each other and being able to read this pattern not only like rationally, but also through the kind of meta language of visual interaction becomes a very powerful way of developing a form of embedded or embodied intelligence.
You're listening to the WGSN Create Tomorrow podcast, and in this episode, we're talking about algae, fungi, and slime mold, those microorganisms that often go unnoticed, but through biodesign, they just might help us to create a better future. I'm Bethan Ryder, Director of Editorial at WGSN, and my guests today are Marco Paletto and Claudia Pesquero, architects, academics, and co-founders of Ecologic Studio. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your air bubble project, which looked really fun. I think the first one was in Warsaw, and this was a construction for children, right? Because obviously there's been an awful lot in the press, certainly in England, London, about the poor air quality. And actually, I think at least one child has lost their life to poor air quality. So this is obviously a really important work that you're doing.
I think the project, the air bubble for us, was significant, of course, because we also have two children and we are living in London, and we just felt very strongly about the issue of air quality and air pollution and the effects it has on children, which is, of course, unique because of their developing respiratory systems. So the impact that air pollution has on children is potentially much more dangerous and long-lasting, in a sense, than in adults. But also the conversation, again, like in many of these aspects around the problem, it's always operating at a level where it feels like it's a problem that is bigger than anyone, and you know, it will take years between solving. Maybe electric cars can help, and so on and so forth. But we felt that actually there was another perspective, another way to look at this that would make it not only more tangible, but also that would give us a way to act immediately, in a sense. And the realization is that if you look at it from the perspective of a child, like, in, you know, from the point of view of a child, you realize that, first of all, children are breathing air at a different height. They are breathing air very intensively when they run and they play, because obviously they have a different pattern of movement and dynamic. But they also spend a significant amount of time in certain areas, like playground, for example, and that's where they're breathing is intense, because so we felt that we could begin to look at the problem of urban air pollution from, let's say, a microclimatic perspective. And we started to take measurement. We used monitors, and then we actually have this really small device that you can take with you. We gave some to our children. We kind of tried to understand really the project from that point of view. And we realized that effectively we could have a significant impact just by beginning to alter or filter the air of a small microclimatic pockets, right? And so that's where the idea of the air bubble came about. We say, okay, look, you know, we're not going to purify the whole air of the whole city overnight, right? It's impossible. But what we can do pretty quickly is to filter a bubble of clean air in a location where children are likely to spend most of their time and also are likely to have a very intense physical exertion, which means that they will be breathing, you know, full lungs. And so that's where the whole idea started. And then, of course, there was an element of technology and technical developments in integrating the photosynthetic vessels in it and, you know, designing a structure that would still feel open and transparent, but would have enough control. So we have this very thin membrane that you see around.
So to describe looking at it, because there's a picture here, it reminds me in, not in scale, but in structure, like actually a gas cylinder, which sounds is like quite amusing, but because it's the opposite kind of thing. And it's got timber supports at the bottom, which is open. And then you've got obviously this membrane, which is transparent.
It creates a microclimate, but really it's an architectural structure in itself that interacts with the environment, with the kids and with the microalgae. In a way, it reconnects to the question of intelligence we were talking about before, because it envisions ecology, not in terms of master planning. In the word master planning, there is a master planner that from the top down decide where kids walk, where algae go, where do we filter. And I found it a little bit also patronizing, aside from the fact that I don't think it works with ecological system. And in this sense, it's about really unlocking agency. The agency of the local environment, the agency of the algae, and the agency of the kids in playing, interacting with the algae in the air, and changing the world around them. So the way it works is really a relationship between the morphology that you see there that allow air recirculation, the playing of the kids that activate the bubbling and the transformation of air, and the air that change in that moment. Of course, this is something we can measure. We've been measuring it. We partner with GSK, pharmaceutical company, for this project, and we measure a reduction of the main element, dangerous element in the air between 75 and 95% every week. But also through interaction, you really allow kids to understand about ecology, about this bubble of microclimate that surrounds us and interact more or less and understand how play and fun and can contribute to the planet ecology. And this is really an important factor of the project, how kids are more healthy, but also maybe more holistically integrated and able to take charge of their own microclimate and understand it more in the future.
It feels like at the very heart of your practice is not just sort of multi-species thinking, but it is this incredibly inclusive way of working where you're just, there are no silos, there's no, you're cross-discipline in every way. Is that something you both just feel like you naturally were always feeling like that about things? Is it something that's how you've shaped the practice as you've gone along?
I always had a very deep interest in art, but also very deep interest in science. And when I was in primary school, I would always resolve mathematical problem visually, which was unconventional. And the teacher would always be, but how did you do that? But you are the only one that get it all right. So you couldn't possibly copy from somebody else. Somehow now I reconnect this also to the way I grew up. I grew up in a farm in Italy. My family produced wine, and the production of wine had a lot of science embedded into it, but also a lot of visual aspect. It was the main element that of the town, and there was a fair, and there was a visual pleasure connected to the harvest and to the moment of the harvest. It was a crucial social, political, aesthetic, as well as productive, economical moment of the town. And you couldn't pick up one of these systems from the other. You know, you now just produce and then you just have the fair. They all was interconnected. And I think when I was maybe the most intellectual of the family and I got a lot into art and science, and I think this interest that I always had, and at the beginning I was struggling because they would ask me to decide, and shall I do engineering, and then I did drama school as well, and then sculpture, and I completed all of them, and I like, I can't decide.
You're mixing them all now.
Yeah, and the question was really how you trace correlation between different realm of knowledge that were being created, and no one is more objective than another one. A flower, you can describe it through the algorithm that are behind its growth, the science, the biology, but also a drawing, a painting, a music. And no one of these descriptions is, in my opinion, more objective than the other. The flower ontologically remains the flower. And the question is that we need to use all our knowledge to read ecology and all our skills to interact with it and develop a different planet.
Marco, how is slime mold going to actually help people and planet in the future and studying slime mold?
Personally, I think slime mold is fascinating because it embodies these different levels at which we communicate with nature. So on one side, you can see it's a metaphor for living urban infrastructure. On the other side, it's a living algorithm. And, you know, on the other end, it's a biological system. So we can, through interacting with slime mold, we can fluctuate between these different kind of understandings, and we can project that onto the design of our cities, or maybe even the design of a cloth or a dress or a medical instrument. And in that sense, it just becomes paradigm for us to look at the new type of
civilization. I understand. So it's like the interconnectedness and the way that it learns and grows and how it adapts is how we could start to make a circular world in following that kind of interconnectedness. As for your studio, I know you've got your book, which is fantastic. What else is on the drawing board at the moment?
Well, we just inaugurated a quite major exhibition in Chengdu as a part of the Art Biennale, which is showcasing one of our most, I think, pioneering sculptures to date, the 3-1, but it's also illustrating our vision about a carbon neutral city of the future. How do we see that from our point of view? So this is, I think, it's been an exciting journey, and it is just open. So I'm pretty excited to share that. It will be there for a few months.
So if someone buys Deep Green, Biodesign in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, what would you hope they would come away with the biggest learning from this?
Start the cyber girl.
Yeah, why not? I think the book is conceived a little bit as a journey. Like I think the first chapter is almost like a white paper for how to cyber garden your surroundings in any different way. So it provides very tangible how-to descriptions and examples of applications of these technologies and in these principles. And then as you move along, the kind of cultural frameworks expand. So from the more hands-on project, you begin to dive into projects that become more and more speculative in terms of scale and framework. And towards the end, really tries to establish a conversation about the nature of intelligence. And in that sense, also, as I was saying before, about our own understanding of who we are and what is our position within the living world. And so ultimately, if our readers want to hang on and reach the end of the book, the idea is that they would begin to themselves contribute to this conversation in terms of who they feel they are and what is their position within society, the community, but also the living world at large.
Thanks to my guests Marco and Claudia of Ecologic Studio. Their book Deep Green, Biodesign in the Age of Artificial Intelligence is out now. If you're a WGSN subscriber, you'll find reports covering the very latest innovations in biodesign in our regular sustainability bulletins and more speculative forecasts around design and architecture on our interiors and our insight platforms. And if you want to find out how to subscribe, head over to WGSN.com to discover how you can get access to our service. We're constantly publishing new content focusing on how we can design a brighter, better future for all of our industries. And these include food and drink, interiors, beauty, fashion, and consumer tech. You can subscribe to the Create Tomorrow podcast on all major platforms. And if you like what you've heard, why not leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts? We'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode. In the meantime, you can catch the CEO of WJSN, Carla Buzashi, next week on our other podcast, Lives of Tomorrow.